Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
And welcome back to the Cribsiders.
Woohoo!
Woo! That's the Spirit Guys, high energy, Justin Burt, joined tonight by our wonderful producers, Angela Zane and Sydney Engel. Say hi, team!
Hello!
Hi, team!
So wonderful to have you both. What an episode. Great guest tonight, Dr. Nakia Showell, who is here to discuss parenting, specifically approaches to discipline and kind of those behavior concerns that come up in clinic all the time. But before we dive into content, Sydney, can you remind us about our show?
Absolutely. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the field to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a really great conversation today with our guest, Dr. Showell. She's the medical director of the Johns Hopkins Harriet Lane Clinic, associate program director of the Pediatrics Residency Program, general pediatrician, and assistant professor of pediatrics of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She's dedicated to a clinical, educational, and research career focused on addressing pediatric socioeconomic and racial and ethnic health disparities among marginalized and minoritized populations. She'll teach us how best to reuse positive reinforcement, form alliance with even the most severe adolescent, and how to give parents the grace and space they need to succeed.
This episode is going to be well spent time out of your day.
Oh. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The delivery was forced, you know? As I forgot the exact wording, but we'll keep it. So this is great. So I love the... So we always love kind of hearing those stories of really kind of understanding and learning. Let's get into some content. I'm excited to talk about our topic, common parenting issue coming up, talking about some behavior, some disciplines. Sydney, why don't you start us off with our first big case?
Absolutely. All right. So our first case, you are seeing Tia, a 2.5-year-old at Cashlack Children's for a well visit. Tia's caregivers are very concerned about the number of tantrums she's having. She's been showing some aggression towards her new baby brother, including pushing him when she was frustrated, although she also has moments of being affectionate towards him. Whenever she doesn't get what she wants, she ends up screaming and crying hysterically. Her speech is somewhat delayed, with rare use of two-word sentences, and she has about a 40-word vocabulary. So I am sure that this is at least a somewhat familiar situation to you. I feel like I encounter things like this on a weekly basis. How do you just in general approach a concerned caregiver when they are talking about this sort of behavior?
Sure. And you're right. This is not an uncommon scenario. And my first approach is providing the parent with reassurance and providing them with hope that this is not uncommon. This is normal behavior. And sometimes it's all you need to hear that sigh of relief from a parent, like, okay, my kid is not different from every other 2.5-year-old. Absolutely not. This is what we see. And then just giving them some grace and giving them positive reinforcement. The fact that you're able to share this concern, I'm happy that we're able to partner with you on this. And here is some possible guidance. So that's one thing. So normalizing, providing reassurance to the parent, giving them some grace, giving them permission to just, it's okay, it's going to be okay. And then recognizing that recognizing some of the things that we're hearing, right? So telling them that for your toddler, they're at an age where they are developing different behaviors. They are testing limits and they're also developing language skills. And they may not be able to put words to how they're feeling and express themselves in a way that is effective, or they feel like they can be heard. So they have big feelings, right? Feeling sad, feeling angry, feeling happy, but not being able to necessarily express those in words. So part of your job as a parent is being able to help them to do that, right? So be able to describe what you're feeling. I see that you're sad. I see that you're sad, and that's okay. I see that you're angry, and that's okay. Trying to redirect or distract them and saying, okay, I see that you're sad. What happened? Tell me about it. And then understanding that there are certain triggers for children, right? So if you know you have a child that with any change in routine or as soon as you leave out the door, they may have a tantrum or may have change in behavior. In this situation, having a younger sibling is not uncommon for children to want to adjust to that, right? So you have a 2.5-year-old who is used to having parents' attention solely, and now there's another child. So this is not uncommon, and we expect to see that there's going to be a period of adjustment. And the parents can certainly, you know, hopefully, and we tell parents to do this, to try to plan and anticipate and let the child be involved in the caregiving of the younger brother to the extent possible. But again, just recognizing that this is normal behavior and can be expected, right? And particularly when there are changes in the home environment or a younger sibling, such like that, things like that.
I love you mentioning the exploring, you know, the communication of their having maybe troubles expressing the feelings and working on talking about the feelings. You also mentioned this is where it's developmentally appropriate to be kind of pushing against boundaries and kind of understanding boundaries. And what, you know, when a parent is maybe asking or how can, you know, when it comes to setting boundaries, when it comes to setting limits, you know, are there specific things of how to do that when the 2.5-year-old is doing something that you want to discourage, like pushing the sibling? How do you set those limits?
So, and again, it depends on the age. And for this period in this age group, I tell parents role modeling is very important. And sometimes you don't have to say anything, but simply take the child away or move their hand away, hitting and being very clear and consistent with what is absolutely not allowed. So not just mom doing it, but dad doing it, other caregivers doing it. Hitting is absolutely not allowed, right? And this would be, you know, situations like this. We really want to tell, want to tell parents it's hard to not say no, because if all, you know, kids hear it or no, there it's hard to respond to a particular behavior. But in situations where they're hitting, they're hurting other people, it may be appropriate to say no or move their hand, take them out of the situation, and role model what is appropriate. Like soft touch. Their baby brother needs soft touch. This is okay. Watch mommy do it. Watch daddy do it. See, this is okay. And that goes a long way because at this age, they're picking up all kinds of behaviors. They're seeing what's in their environment. They're hearing what's in their environment. So you are their first role model, right? And it can really become very much more clear to them, like what's appropriate. And more you do it and the more consistent you are.
I love that focus on redirection, on being a role model for them, obviously very developmentally appropriate for where a 2.5-year-old is at. From a developmental perspective, what can a 2.5-year-old understand in terms of this is a consequence or this is what I can or cannot do? Like what sort of language will get through and what sort of response can you expect?
A great question. So certainly redirection and taking things away in the moment will help them to link that behavior with that particular consequence. For at this age, and particularly in this child who has somewhat delayed speech, she's having difficulty with using two-word sentences and expressing herself. So in this situation, I would also recommend role modeling what words or how to say things that she in a way that she can actually do it, given her speech delay. So when you say, like, if she seems like she's, you know, she's gesturing or muttering and not able to say what she wants, you can actually role model and say, okay, if you want this, say, I want, and can be consistent while also modeling positive behavior. So things like linking consequence with the behavior in the moment and being consistent with that is going to be something that's going to go a long way. For a 2.5-year-old also, and for children in general, praise and positive reinforcement is something they're really going to get. So when she does do, when she's doing soft touch with baby brother, when she is, you know, she didn't throw her toy, she put it down softly, then you want to make sure you're relating that positive language and positive reinforcement immediately and consistently. Like, very good job. Good. You put the toy down. Very good. Because at 2.5, they can understand simple, they can understand commands, right? You soft touch with baby brother. Very good. You're a big sister. So things like that that seem wow, doing a lot of describing and talking, but it's so important. It's so important to do positive praise and to do positive reinforcement, even more so than the punitive and negative reinforcement, right? Because you're trying to mold and shape behaviors. And at this age, they're absorbing and soaking it all up. So you can't do enough. That's my main approach. You cannot do enough, especially at this age. Everything is good. Everything that you want them to do, praise it. That's what I tell parents. Praise it, praise it, praise it. Oh my gosh, you got your shoe. You gave me your sock. And parents look at me and they're like, I'm not doing all of that. That is, I was like, we don't have those. Like, but I'm telling you, just remember, if you can tell yourself today for the things that they are doing that you want them to do, don't forget to push some praise in there and some positive reinforcement. You will thank me later. I'm telling you.
I feel like this is applicable really for all ages, right? And that, like, in right. working with medical yes. students and residents too, it's like,
yes.
that was like,
yes.
catch them doing something
positive
good.
Positive reinforcement. Yes.
It's
positive
such
reinforcement.
A good, absolutely.
And there are different incentives the older you get, right? But for a kiddo, I mean, just the hearing language and seeing, remember, they're looking at your expressions, right? And how you interact and how you engage with them. So they're seeing you happy. They're seeing you smiling at things that you do. And so you want to make sure that your emotions and your presence also reflects that positivity as well.
I actually would kind of love to talk about the speech development, and that we talked about this child having, you know, maybe some limited vocabulary, or for some kiddos where we provide reassurance and kind of say, don't worry, like, the kid's going to speak eventually. But when the struggle comes from the communication, mm-hmm. I guess, is there a connection between speech development and a child's
yeah.
behavior? And maybe when are we starting to think about, is this something we need to explore more with mm-hmm. SLP or some other type of workup?
Yep. And that's a great question. So we know that sometimes, and particularly in kiddos who kind of manifest with maybe sudden change in behavior, that change in behavior can be one of the first signs of developmental delay, right? Because kiddos are having a hard time expressing themselves in a way that is heard and that actually gets to what they want. Right. And so we definitely see change in behavior as a sign of developmental delay. So there is a linkage. But also in this case, thinking about what are the new stressors or changes in the environment for that child and what they may be reacting to. So again, not uncommon to see just adjustments like this around younger siblings and things like that. But also sometimes you see regression and developmental milestones around younger siblings. So a kiddo who is fully potty trained, all of a sudden they have, you know, more bedwetting. And again, we counsel parents on that's an adjustment that can happen, that can be expected. And this is how we move forward around that. So recognizing that, yes, there could be developmental delay and there could be regression as a result of a new change in environment is important too. So the question would be for this family, like, have you noticed that she's doing things in a different way? And also we need to think about other causes of developmental delay and regression. But is there something new since the younger baby came around? Or is this always been the case? Have they lost milestones? So those are other questions that you would want to ask and engage with the parents around.
Yeah, I really love that. And I think it just shows, like, how much of a range is, like, expected in parenting. And I think parents can feel, like, very guilty or very taken aback when mm-hmm. something isn't going the way they thought
right.
they would.
Right.
In terms of these, like, resources, yeah, like, at what point are you, like, this is maybe a little bit out of proportion
yeah.
to this change.
Mm-hmm.
Something
mm-hmm.
is happening either in the development or something's happening in their home that
right.
they need more resources for, and how do you get them there?
Right. So certainly beyond, you know, younger sibling is no longer an infant and they're still showing behavioral concerns, right? So if it's persistent in terms of the behavioral changes, if there's intense behavior control or behavior changes, certainly we want to know about that. Or if there's regression in developmental milestones and that persists, right? So it's not just a change. It's not just that they started bedwetting and now all of a sudden they are completely wet and they are never dry. That's, to me, more concerning than, oh, a couple weeks when baby was born and now they're back to where they were. So it's the persistence and intensity of behavior change or developmental delay. And at any point, honestly, if the parents, for me, if parents come concerned and they're like, this is really unlike my child. Parents know their children best. And we, as pediatricians, we have to listen and definitely value and prioritize their concerns. So if a parent comes to me and say, I don't think it's the baby, something is not right. My gut is telling me something is not right, and there's nothing else going on, but I'm concerned. That's an opportunity for me, for us to partner with the family and to think about, let's do a more comprehensive evaluation. Is there something physically going on, right? Is there an underlying, organic process that we need to think about? How's the child growing? How's the child physically developing? We need to think more outside the box as well, if there are those concerns. So at any point that the parents are concerned, we're concerned. That's the bottom line. And if a parent really feels that a child should be evaluated, and particularly in a child like this where there are signs of developmental delay, then we should respect that, right? And also offer reassurance when reassurance is indicated. And in a child like this, again, I think there is definitely reasons why there's changes in behavior. And she does have mild speech delay. And there's other things that we can do that may not be as intensive, but definitely respecting the parents' concerns and trying some things and putting some things into play to see how things proceed.
One of the things you mentioned is the persistence and the severity.
Yeah.
And I think a challenge that sometimes I'll have is when a parent will say, okay, fine, doc, it's a phase. When is this going to stop?
Right, you know, like right.
What is persistence? I think that's what the parent wants to know. Is this a three-month thing, a one-year thing?
Right.
When you start thinking like this is persistent and maybe problematic.
Yeah. So for tantrums, I say it does get better. It does get better. We usually say around like after the age of three, kiddos tend to have less tantrums as they're developing, as they're maturing, but it does get better. And it's hard though, right? It's hard for parents to hear that and say like, wow, I don't want to do another day of this. This is tough. This is really tough. And that's where it's helpful to partner with families and see what they've already tried. Right? What they've already tried, what they're willing to do. And then we also can incorporate some strategies that may be helpful, right? But also respecting where they are and some of the things that they've tried or their family has tried. And I think you get a lot of information around what you can suggest or what particular strategies you can suggest based on what is already being done, right? So some parents don't even recognize like, wow, doing praise, like positive reinforcement will help. I thought just like telling them no will get rid of the behavior, right? That's the only thing I would need to do. But so understanding what they've already done, how you can add to that, but also respecting like their own values and kind of, family culture of doing things with regards to discipline is really helpful.
Hey, Cripsiders listeners, we're back with another sponsor. This is all about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Freed was built for clinicians by their significant others. Gabby, a family med physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, are married. Erez built Freed so Gabby could stop charting over the weekends. It was one of those selfish presents that you secretly get for yourself. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you instantly. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before your patient even walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like any human scribe, and most importantly, it is HIPAA compliant. So you can try 10 notes for free, and after that, it only costs $99 per month. But better yet, Cribsiders listeners can get $50 off that first month. So try Freed for free right now by going to getfreed.ai. That's GETFREE.AI. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off that first month.
When you talk about strategies, I know you've kind of talked about some general framework for this, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on other either more creative or maybe more complex strategies. I'm curious, like, is there good data around like things like sticker charts or anything like that for or other things that you've heard of that maybe we could suggest to families as options to try?
Yeah. So again, depending on the age, and there are some good evidence regarding certain strategies. But what I say for parents is that although we have recommendations and although some things work and we think work in theory, right, every child is different. And so we can't promise that timeout will work for every child or you know, doing anticipation or distraction or reinforcement will work the same way for every child. But here are some things that may be commonly effective, at least in the literature, but every child is different. So use your judgment in terms of what works. So to your question around like what particular strategies, so I think we've all heard of the timeout strategy. And this is really good for kind of reinforcing like particular rules or like rules being broken. So if a child, you know, continually throws a toy at their brother, and that's a rule, you warn children first. So this is where Karens get a little mixed up. You have to warn them first so they know what rule is being broken, not just say time out because you did X. So you warn them first, like if you throw it again, it's time out. You warn them first, and then when they do it again, despite the warning, then you say, okay, you're in timeout because you threw the toy, right? Then you have to restate what the broken rule was. And give yourself grace and give the child grace. This is going to be hard the first time around, but you have to be consistent. And typically we say, you know, a minute per age. So like a year and change, it can be like a minute. The older they get, like the three-year-old has a better ability to comprehend and understand consequences. So sometimes I tell parents, you can actually allow them to, you know, you go in timeout and you let me know when you're ready. You know, at three, they may be able to understand that depending on the child. But that's like one strategy that may be effective. It may not work for every child, but there are other things. So again, thinking about consequences, being consistent, being clear and consistent amongst caregivers, setting limits. That's not the easiest thing to employ, right? When your child is actively having a tantrum, right? So like, oh, you need to set limits. But what does that look like when your kid is just like, you feel completely out of control? So I'll tell parents, setting limits is probably a good thing to do when child is not actively in a tantrum, but being proactive about, this is when we go over auntie's house, there's no ice cream or whatever that rule is. That's a little harsh for the babies, but there's no this. So just so you know, set limits prior to so they can anticipate. And then again, positive reinforcement. And then know when it's hard for parents to do this, but unless your child is at danger of hurting themselves or actively hurting themselves or hurting somebody else, ignoring unwanted behaviors is okay. It is totally okay. When my younger brother was young and we would be in Sam's Club or Costco or somewhere, and he had terrible tantrums. Mom would leave him in the middle of the aisle and walk away. Man, he was fine. He would just go. And then as soon as she walked away, he got up and went right after. So he was not in danger of hurting himself. He was on the floor just, you know, I don't know. And she just said, okay, I'm going to continue shopping. And he immediately went up. And so I know that's hard for parents to do, particularly in public places, but pick your battles, right? Pick your battles. And every situation may ask for something different, right? So if you are in a place where you have to be really, really quiet, may not be able to let them just, you know, just fight it out with themselves. But everything doesn't have to be responded to. And the other thing with timeout, and even when you're responding to tantrums and letting and not respond, you know, not responding, be very clear in ways that they can understand. Timeout is for X. We don't, you know, long soliloquies and paragraphs around why, you know, why this was not necessary. And if you did this, you know, And as much as parents want to be able to do that, the kids are not understanding in the moment. Just be very straightforward, short phrase sentences. This is why this is happening. And you move on. You don't need to have a lot of, you know, a lot of flowery language and this and that. This is what it is, particularly at younger ages, right? And then, you know, a big part of parenting is, to the best of your ability, providing attention and being engaged, particularly in moments where you see that there are changes in behavior. And sometimes there is such a thing as quote unquote acting out. And so sometimes I ask parents, you know, because of kids can express themselves in different ways. Sometimes behavior changes or even increase in tantrums could be because they feel like there's less attention being given on them compared to the younger sibling. So as much as possible, making sure you're providing that attention and direct attention and being responsive to their changes in their behavior and cues and following their cues when you can, when recognizing that there are, you know, different times that you have to do other things. But as much as possible, giving them the attention that they need, particularly in earlier years, is really important.
And these are some really great tips and also a really great framework, I think, as you've alluded to, for really any age would be helpful. I think we were saying before, like, you don't really learn this stuff in medical school, and it's kind of like learned by trial and observing parents and what they're doing really well throughout residency or maybe being a parent yourself. We'd love to move on to maybe an older child, because I think you mentioned sometimes that approaches might change. So let's say your patient is actually Darian. You know, he's 10 years old. He's in fifth grade. He started to push back against bedtime, started being picky about foods, things like that around the house and around school. How does your framework change for somebody who's a bit more school aged in terms of setting boundaries, pushing limits?
Yeah, so at this age, there is, you know, much more understanding, higher level of understanding and knowledge of consequences, right? And you can have those conversations of, like, if you do A, B can happen or C can happen. And again, I always start with the approach of recognizing what's expected, what's normal behavior, and giving yourself and your child grace and opportunity to be themselves, trying to understand where they're coming from. At 10, you can have a conversation with them, like, what's happening? What's going on? Why did this change? And tell me your understanding of what bedtime rules are. Because maybe they think, now that I'm 10, I don't have to go to bed at 9 o'clock anymore. I can go to bed at midnight. And there's your problem. There's your problem solved right there, right? So that's one of the things that you can do differently with school-aged children, with older children, is having conversation in a different way. And because they have a different understanding of the consequence of their actions, and then still being very clear, this goes for all ages, clear and consistent with rules that you have put in place. And with an older child, being able to gauge understanding and interpretation of those rules is really important, because you just may be on different pages. Continuing to role model. Role modeling goes a long way, even at younger, at older ages. And making sure, and also providing reassurance to parents that this is also an age where a lot of things are changing. Right? They're pre-adolescent, so they're undergoing lots of physical, social development changes, probably changes in their body, and trying to understand that. So again, very normal, very much expected, and just providing that space to be able to have those conversations about it.
Before we move on to some more concrete examples, I would love to pause here and zoom out a little bit and talk about discipline in general, which is what we're really focusing on today. You know, like, I grew up here in the U.S. and I'm trained as a U.S. pediatrician. And I think there is a very U.S. Western-centric way of parenting that we're taught is like the dominant correct way. Like, I'll say my parents were not raised this way. I was not necessarily raised this way. And so how do you, keep those like cultural factors in mind when you're counseling parents?
Yeah, and great, great, great question. So I'm one of those pediatricians, I like to ask questions about how parents were raised, because it gives me a lot of insight and information, possible information on how, on what informs their approach. And I can get information exactly to your point, Angela, around like, what are their values? What are their family's values? What are the things that have been role modeled for them? Because if I'm suggesting something that's completely in opposition to what they grew up believing, is it as feasible? Is it going to be feasible to happen? I don't know. I don't know, right? And so understanding where they're coming from first, meeting parents where they are, and recognizing the importance of their family values and influences, where they grew up, right? And I agree with you that part of parenting that's misinterpreted is that it needs to be in this perfect box of doing things, that there's this perfect way of parenting. And it is embedded in a very westernized, Eurocentric foundation. But everybody is different. So how I grew up could be different from how you grew up. And recognizing that we as pediatricians have our own biases, and our own biases based on our own experiences. And so I'm very clear with those up front. And sometimes parents ask me, well, what worked for me, right? And how I grew up. And I can say what I agreed with or not, or disagreed with. And the other piece around that is asking parents, well, what about the ways that you were, you know, that you either raised your first child or how you were raised, do you agree with for this child? And what don't you agree with? And what do you think would be helpful for this child? Because again, everybody is different. Your child is not a twin, and your other children are not this, your other child is not the same as this child. So that's how I kind of take the approach of, okay, let's figure out what those influences are before I prescribe, before I suggest, before I counsel. And parents appreciate that because I'm asking their opinion first versus telling them what should be done. And again, there are concrete, there are particular strategies that can be helpful, but without context, right? Without context, it's harder to be able to implement. And it's harder for parents to really try to interpret that information without recognizing their other influences.
I love that. I think that's something that I might start doing immediately when parents are mm-hmm. asking about discipline and behavioral changes, mm-hmm. asking, it's a knee-jerk response, like, how are you raised? What are things that you appreciated? Because mm-hmm. I find sometimes, especially in things like maybe spanking or corporal yep. punishment, where yep. I start explaining why I discourage that or think mm-hmm. that, might demonstrate other violent behavior. There's right. also, there's often that immediate pushback of that's how I was raised, and exactly. almost reversing right. the script right. is such a better way. It's almost like a motivational interviewing technique. Mm-hmm. I love that. I think that's something that I will start using immediately. I love that as an approach and communication approach. And then you do mention some types of discipline and strategies that are evidence-based and kind mm-hmm. of focusing on that. And mm-hmm. in this kiddo of a 10-year-old who's really starting to push back at kind of a higher maturity, mm-hmm. What are some of those evidence mm-hmm. strategies that we might use for a 10-year-old?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So understanding and setting limits, being clear and consistent. For a 10-year-old, again, having conversations, and this is for also the older children as well, when you give consequences and provide those consequences up front and have a discussion around those consequences, that's much more helpful than kind of reacting with consequences, right? So if the 10-year-old knows you continue to go to bed at 10 o'clock and your bedtime is 8 o'clock, the television will be taken out of your room. If you tell them that up front versus, okay, I'm taking the television out of the room, evidence shows that they're more likely to follow those consequences. So giving consequences and being clear and consistent with those consequences up front, setting limits, and making sure that those are consistently followed, not just within the household, but in other settings. So if the 10-year-old is with aunt or uncle or another caregiver, like two weekends in the month, it can be hard to be consistent across different caregivers, but it's really, really, really is helpful in terms of promoting those desired behaviors if there are consistency across caregivers. So that's another strategy that has been recommended. And again, being responsive to social cues and engaging with your children, showing and demonstrating and role modeling love, compassion is critical. Role modeling is something that has been throughout the spectrum and throughout the age spectrum for children is critically important. And it's the same thing for the 10-year-old as the 2.5-year-old as the older child. Role modeling is critical. And the type of role modeling should be one that is based in positivity, one that's based in how my level of responsiveness is directly in relation to what you're giving me. And being attentive, right? And being attentive. So those are some of the things that I tell parents. And again, recognizing that it's hard to do all of these things all the time and give yourself space and grace. That's what I say. Give yourself space and grace. You do not have to be. There's no such thing as a perfect parent. Like that is my tell parents that all the time. There is no such thing. We are all learning as we go. We learn something new every day about our children, right? And so those are the things that I would definitely recommend. And be prepared to expect that things aren't going to go well. They're always going to go well. And that's fine. It is totally fine. From day to day, be prepared for things not to go well, for your child to stop going to bed on time or stop listening to you. Be prepared for that. That's going to happen. I think preparation also helps and anticipation. And for some parents, it could be really anxiety invoking, but at least know that this is to try to normalize that.
I love that. I feel like this is a really, the way you just framed that, it's a really beautiful amalgamation of validating the parents, mm-hmm. reassuring them, mm-hmm. meeting the kid where they're at, and also kind of providing the framework for them to be able to address behaviors as they arise. And I think, those are not easy things to do. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to be able to be partners to parents in this and have humility about what we can offer, but at least be there for them through this. As we kind of think about the challenges that are going to arise, I know that one big phase that parents get anxious about is adolescence. So I want to move on from school age. We could talk about that for a long time, but to this kind of key parenting moment. So for this case, let's say that we're seeing 16-year-old Jamie, whose mom says, I just really need you to talk to them. They're not listening to us anymore. The mom says that Jamie has been ignoring their parents when asked to do things like chores or putting the phone away. They come home after curfew. When you talk to Jamie alone, they say they just don't really understand what the big deal is. And I really hate that my mom's making me talk to you about this. In terms of just some social factors, they tried alcohol at a party a couple times and their PHQ-9 score is 3. So can you just provide a general framework for adolescence, you know, small topic, but just yeah. Why is this happening and what exactly is happening?
Yeah, adolescent, no small topic at all. Wow. So again, with adolescence, lots of development. During this stage, adolescents are developing a stronger sense of self and independence. It is normal to what I tell parents to test the waters, right? They are, you want to talk about testing limits, this is the time right here. And they're going to be testing different types of limits, right? So the kind of risk-taking behaviors that are described here with adolescents, this is why it's important to understand and ask. And I tell parents, you know, they say, well, is this normal? That's what they ask. Like, is this normal for my kid to just try this, try this, try this? It's like, and then I'd ask them, I said, you remember when you were a teen? Right? You go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep. Right. Remember when you were a teen? You were experimenting, right? You were trying to figure out where you fit into this world, how you want to present, what do you want to be perceived as. You were very much like, okay, I'm trying to figure these things out. So this is no different from your child. Yes, we're in a totally different age with definitely different opportunities, I would say, different ways of communicating and social media and all of that. But the sense of kind of figuring things out while I'm maturing, trying to be comfortable with self and where I present in the world has not changed. And that's what adolescence is defined by. And so my general approach is, one, normalizing, give yourself grace and space, but also really, really important, as much as you can, is to try to understand. This is the time where you can have conversations and be very honest and transparent. Conversations based on mutual respect, not just you telling your adolescent that you're the mutual respect, right? Throughout childhood, really. And respecting that they're not going to always want to talk or engage with you. And in fact, they'd probably rather call up their BFF, right? And so it's important, and parents get really saddened by that, that their teens are now not their allies. One parent told me, he's not my ally. And I was like, well, I don't know if the goal of parenting is to be an ally, best friend, because that's going to be hard. And I think the goal of being a parent is to be a parent, is figure out how you can support them and encourage them in the things that they do. So in these conversations, lots of, again, positive reinforcement, support, but understanding what drives them and what their expectations and goals are is really important, right? And you can share what your goals and expectations are. So this is a time where you can do that. So they understand where you're coming from, you understand where they're coming from. And knowing how they spend their time and how they would like to engage with you, but recognizing that there are still boundaries, right? And being very clear and consistent with those boundaries and those limits. And then recognizing that this is a period of not just rapid development, but lots of hormonal changes, physical changes, and they're curious about a lot. And so making sure that you or someone that you know are trusted sources of information. I tell parents of teens, it's really great that teens have opportunity to talk to us one-on-one, right? Because we're a trusted source of information. And if we can't provide a role model like that kind of confidential space, they may not have a forum elsewhere to be able to share things that are on their mind. So bidirectional respect, grace and space, being clear and consistent with boundaries, but really trying to understand where your teen is and recognizing that they don't always want to talk to you. And that's totally fine. That is completely fine. They give them permission to be themselves and also be welcoming when they are ready to talk to you, right? And be open to those conversations.
Maybe it's part of that. I would love, this is such great counseling that I think I can try to mirror and model and use with parents. The chief complaint of, I just need you to talk to them for me, I feel like is very common when a parent's bringing in an adolescent, especially, you know, if it's like it's a mild adolescent, fine, but severe adolescent, you know,
right.
you really.
Right.
And I feel like there's these times where the parent will be like, will you just tell them that vaping's bad so they stop vaping?
Yes.
Or something like this. And I feel that almost challenges that relationship. And maybe going along this, how do you either talk to the kid one-on-one where the goal is not necessarily to get them to stop vaping, but communicate with the parent? Or maybe it is to – how do you kind of approach some of these complex
Yeah, that's a great, really great question. We're often told to do things – that they're listening to you. That's what we're also hearing.
Right,
yeah, they'll listen to you, Doc. And like I told you, Doc said, so now you have to do it. I'm like, okay. Tell the parents, like, I'm still an adult and they see me as another adult. and they're going to say, like, of course the doctor will say this and of course the doctor will align themselves with my parents. So I think the first approach is kind of pushing back on that piece, right? Because teen patients might feel that you're always going to be on the side of the parent. You're taking sides of the parent. So they're going to use you to transmit information that they've been telling me and they think that I'm going to hear. So that's
I'm
where
an
I
ally.
Start. Right. Right. I'm an ally. Right. You're an ally. And I'm, yeah. So the first thing is to kind of push back on that perception. And when I'm speaking to teens one-on-one, I'm making it very clear, like, the conversations that we have, I'm here as, you know, as an individual speaking with you one-on-one, right? There are certain things that we can speak about confidentially, and I want to respect that. And I want you to feel that I'm your trusted ally. I'm not taking sides on behalf of your parents. There are things that really are unhealthy for you. Of course, as your doctor, I'm going to share that. But first, I want to understand, like, what are your goals? Like, what are you most concerned about, right? And I also start with, like, what are your dreams and, like, what are your nightmares? Because then it gives me a sense of, like, what they're aspiring to do and, like, what are their worst fears. And you can get a lot of information around that. And so I broach it by kind of breaking this perceived alignment with just parents, right? Because my focus and my dedication is really about you, and we're working together, your parents and I, to make sure that you're as healthy as possible. That we're on the same team, but I am your, you know, right now it's you and I one-on-one. And so that's kind of how I go about it. And I express to the parents, I tell them straight up in front of you, I can tell you that this is not good for you, but you don't have to be out of the room for me to tell your teen that vaping is not good for your child. And they're not going to listen to me more because you're out of the room. They're either going to listen to us or not. But what it does do is provide, what we can do is provide space and a forum to be able to get to additional and cover additional things that they may or may not feel comfortable covering. But I always give them opportunity to speak in front of the parents too, because I think that's important for us to be those kind of facilitators for those conversations.
You know, I think a big part, like you said, of this adolescent visit is that you're spending one-on-one time with them, and you're really talking a lot about their goals and their fears and their feelings. And this is a big feeling age or set of ages. And so there are a lot of new feelings, big feelings. And so how do you help adolescents manage those emotions and work through them in a healthy way?
This is a period of time which it can be really almost overwhelming, I think, to some adolescents and to parents, right, in terms of how emotions can change and how abruptly emotions and feelings can change. And what I always start off with is, one, I always have the normalizing conversation, but two, destigmatizing when it's necessary and when there are signs that managing your emotions yourself may not be sufficient. And I start there because I think that with adolescents, they're trying to form this sense of self and that I got it all in control. I can handle this myself. And parents, similarly, they're like, I know my child. I know that we can work this out together. So I really kind of context frame the conversation. Like, this is why we're asking. Like, one, this is normal. These shifts are normal. Sometimes it can get intense. Sometimes it can feel overwhelming. And we ask this because we want you to be prepared if this is how things proceed and this is how you feel. And this is normal. It's also normal to be able to get help. So those are, that's kind of the line of conversation that we have. And I have that, particularly if there are concerns that the parents bring up about emotionals, I have that in front of parent and adolescent, and then we have private conversations around it. And we may get more details on some of those triggers, some of which may be a parent conflict and, you know, not getting along with teachers and things like that. But I have that conversation intentionally with the parents there, right? Because you both need to be able to recognize signs of and feelings that may be that may be telling you we need to go somewhere else, right? Like we need to think about something else. And then in terms of like self-management tools, so I love books as an outlet, right? So I kind of start sharing some of my outlets, and I ask adolescents, like, what do you typically do? I'm like, oh, I just get on my phone and things like that. And I was like, okay. And I said, so that's a lot of stimulation, but what relaxes you? Does that tend to relax you, or does it tend to get you more excited, right? And depending on the answer to that, right, we can talk about, well, here's another way you can get on your phone, but it's something that's relaxing. So we think about like meditation apps and calming apps and things like that. And then I talk about friends and the importance of having support systems, even outside of the family. And I typically always ask, you know, in addition to your parents, or maybe it's not your parent, is there one person, one adult that you feel like you would go to if things feel really bad? Identify that person. So I know mom or dad knows, you know, aunt knows, whoever knows, that's the person. It could be an older sibling. And then we talk about what it means to seek help and when that may be necessary. And what is therapy, right? So some adolescents think, like, I don't want to talk to anybody. I'm talking to you. And I want to just talk about my feelings. So we go through what that means. So those are some of the approaches that I start with. And then understanding, like, what are some of the things, like extracurricular activities that could be helpful. We talk about the importance of sleep, of proper sleep, of going to bed, you know, before 2 hours before you have to get up for school, of sports, of just walking and moving your body and the effects on your mental health and mood. So all of those things, but really gauging what they're interested in. What's feasible for them and what are their aspirations? You know, maybe their goal is to, I just want to feel happy 3 days instead of just only one day, right? Just being very concrete and very specific around some of the goals they have for themselves.
And maybe, can I ask, you know, I think these are really great tips, especially the, you know, kind of just the normalizing of, again, what's developmentally appropriate. In adolescent medicine, or when there's an adolescent who really is starting to spiral, or maybe mm-hmm. a parent grounds them and they sneak mm-hmm. out, or a parent takes away their phone and they steal their phone back, and it seems like they're really hitting, you know, the complicated stages where these boundaries are consistently being broken. Mm-hmm. When are you starting to think of, in my mind, I feel like there's not like a referral, I mean, that's maybe adolescent medicine to an extent, but there's not like a great referral of here's how to improve the limit setting for your adolescent child. Mm-hmm. Is there any different approach that you take or advice you take when it is becoming, you know, mm-hmm. when drug use is persistently mm-hmm. involved, when maybe criminal justice is involved, mm-hmm. and that there needs to be kind of this higher level of mm-hmm. intervention?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, in this stage, this period, in parents, and some of the things that I suggest is trying to understand, like, what are the things that they really desire. So we think about, like, or what are the things they really like to do. So we think about, like, you know, consequences as it looks in terms of, like, privileges, being taken. And on the flip side of that, which is equally as important, is, like, what are some of the things, like, the earned freedoms, right? Like, the things that you can acquire. Because we tend to think about parenting and discipline from just what you can take away, but not necessarily what you can add. And so I ask those two questions, like, what are the things that they really like to do, right? For both a privilege, you know, if you had to remove privileges to do X, Y, and Z, but also if you had to add those back when you do have changes in behavior. So that's one thing, being very specific about those things. And the other, and relatedly, you know, things like, you know, being grounded. But what does being grounded mean, right? If you don't know what's valued to the adolescent. So I tend to really center on privileges and consequences and also earned freedoms. So things that you can take away if the X is done, and then things that you can add back if Y is done, right? If positive change in behavior is done, and start from there. And recognizing that for every adolescent, that's going to be different. So for certain adolescents, you may have to take away 3 privileges. Certain adolescents, you may not have to take anything away at all, but just the warning is enough, right? And so, and I also tell parents, it's not fair for adolescents to presume that what a consequence will be if you've never told them. He should know that you're not going to have this PlayStation anymore. You should just know that. Like, does he assume that? I don't think anybody assumes you're going to take away what they love. But a warning, the same thing we talked about with the younger kids, a warning, like being consistent. Like, if you continue to, you know, be out past your curfew, this will happen. You won't have a car to drive anywhere else, right? You won't have access to the car. Not, you know, you're past your curfew. Now you don't have a car, right? That's less effective. So, you know, from an effectiveness standpoint, it's helpful to state, reiterate, right, and emphasize those consequences and link those with particular actions or behaviors. But it's also as important to have positive reinforcement, praise, and earned freedoms in the mix, in the same conversation. Can't just be punitive, right, when we're talking about discipline. We also have to come from a positive and positive reinforcement perspective too.
I love that. I feel like that's a general theme across all ages, mm-hmm. you know, modeling love, compassion, positive reinforcement. Mm-hmm. And I think a really great kind of concept and thing to start ending on. And so would love, you know, we've talked a lot about at different ages, different approaches and strategies to normalize and to encourage positive behavior. What are some of the other, or what are the main take-home points that you want our listeners to walk away with about discipline and kind of counseling caregivers about behavioral concerns from
one, that there's no perfect parent. There's no perfect parenting style. Nothing. Everything is imperfect. And I've said this a lot, but there's no best fit approach for every child, right? What works for this child may not work for this other child. What works for you as a child growing up and now you're a parent may not work for your child. So that is the number one message. And two, and I've said this several times, like, give yourself grace and space. I coined that for this conversation, grace and space. And it's okay. When parents see their pediatrician telling them it is okay to feel out of control, to lose control and never regain control because their kid is like, oh my gosh. And other parents go through the same thing. That goes a long way. So that if we don't do anything else, if you just tell the parent is in front of you, it is completely fine. We get it. You're not alone and it is okay. Who else can help you while you walk to the other room and leave the child there right there? Somebody else can come in. You take a break. Give yourself some space and grace. And then three, I get this a lot from trainees as well, like who are not parents. And so they feel less empowered to give advice on parenting. Right? They feel less of an expert, of, you know, having less expertise. And I always tell them, and similar, I was like, well, you know what? They're first time parents and they've never had children before, but we expect them to be experts. We expect them to know everything. So you also have to give yourself some grace. And parenting is not learned through books and through recommendations. It's also from experience, but it's also from listening to others' experiences. So you learn from your, like, as a trainee who may not have children, learn from other parents, learn from your own parents. What worked, what didn't work? Reflect on your own child rearing experiences for you as a child. So, and that comes with also having conversations and learning from parents that you interact with and being upfront about your own biases around parenting. I wouldn't lead with, well, I don't actually know if this is correct because I'm not a parent. I don't think this would work because I don't know. I'm not a parent, right? Understand they're also looking to you, right? They are first time parents and they've never done this before. So they're looking to you and you all can partner together and come to common grounds and figure out things together. So that would be my my third thing. And then lastly, positive reinforcement and praise goes such a long way. immediately when we think about discipline, we think about punitive and punishment. We don't think about discipline that involves as much, to me, as it involving a positive foundation. And praising, you cannot praise your children enough, especially when they're younger and they're creating and they're getting learning behaviors and learning preferences. If you really want to reinforce positive behaviors, employ praise more, I would say more than you employ negative disciplinary actions and negative reinforcement.
Love it. And for anyone who wants to learn more, are there any other resources or anything that you'd like to plug that you think our listeners should check out?
Yeah. So I really like the AAPHealthyChildren.org website, which is a AAP sponsored, parent-friendly website for various topics. And it's in, you know, in a way that parents can understand. They have videos, they have links to other resources, including the CDC, for example, and just got more concrete strategies in terms of, okay, we can try this, try that. So that's an option for parents as well. And the CDC also has similar resources. And to me, your best resource is the parents that you talk to every day. I've learned so much from the parents that I've spoken with day to day. So utilizing your patients as resources in a sense that you're trying to become a better doctor and be able to counsel on a topic that is not simple, and it's not something that we really learn in medical school, right? And we're not going to get it right every time, and there's no perfect way of doing it. So all you can go off experiences, even if you have your own experiences from your own way growing up, or talking to parents about their experiences and being able to say, you know, I talked to a parent and this worked. This actually worked when their child was teething or their child started hitting. This worked, right? Or when my child, blah, blah, blah. So you learn from your own experiences and learn from those of your patients.
I love it. Amazing, great pearls that I think are helpful in all of the well-child visits across the age, lifespan, and pediatrics. Nakia, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your time, your expertise. We really, really appreciate you. Thanks for coming on the Cribsiders.
Love being here. Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. You can also email us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producers for this episode, Sydney Angel and Angela Zhang, our showrunner, Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Justin Lee Burke.
I've been Angela Zhang.
And this has been Sydney Angel. Thank you and good night.